You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. My conversation today is with Jessica Calarco, who is a sociologist and associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's an award-winning teacher, a leading expert on inequities in family life and education, and she's the author of many books, including her latest, which is called Holding It Together, How Women Became America's Social Safety Net. Important book, important conversation. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with
Jessica Calarco, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You open the book with a historical fact that you say might shock readers, and actually it shocked me. Congress once voted to fund an affordable national child care system. When? Yes. How? What happened?
Yeah. So this is, you know, a sort of hidden history of our country and our society, that we used to have a national child care system that was affordable and high quality and funded by taxpayer dollars. And I think it's important to note that this was put in place during World War II, in part because with so many men off fighting in battle, we needed as many women in the workforce as possible to keep the economy going, not only to run defense production centers like we see with, you know, Rosie the Riveter, but also with running the sort of day-to-day operations, the kinds of jobs that were disproportionately held by men. And at the time, so fairly quickly, we were able to get to almost 100% employment among women without children. But at the time, only about 1 in 30 mothers of young kids were working for pay. And this was in part because at the time, there were laws and employer policies in place in many places that made it difficult, if not impossible, for married women and mothers to hold employment or to, you know, hold jobs other than sort of the most menial ones in our economy. Because there weren't really many options for childcare before the war. And so essentially what happened, folks like Catherine Lenroot, who ran the U.S. Children's Bureau, petitioned Congress to use funding from the Lanham Act to fund child care centers, essentially arguing that if we need women in the workforce, we can't just, you know, tell them to join the workforce. That's not going to work. They need child care. And those centers, it took a long time. Congress sort of dragged its feet in actually putting this program in place. But once it did, they were wildly successful. These kinds of centers offered, in some cases, 10 or 12 hours a day of high-quality care. That was usually less than $10 per day in today's dollars for families in terms of what they were paying. Many places also offered after-school care and summer care for kids who were older. And so this was a sort of high-quality system that existed across the U.S. And that helped to raise the employment rate among mothers of young children from 1 in 30 to 1 in 6 by the end of the war. And certainly, you know, we have to ask, like, well, where did this go? Why don't we still have this today? And essentially, we dismantled it almost as soon as it began. Unlike many of our European allies who use this as a chance to build out a sort of even more robust and permanent child care center, we shuttered those child care centers because we wanted to make sure that the jobs that were available in the U.S. economy could be given back to the men who were returning from war. And in fact, Stephanie Kuntz, who's a historian, talks about in some of her work how not only did we close these child care centers, but we also threatened women with things like electric shock therapy if they refused to go back home, if they weren't happy with being told that they had to abandon the jobs that they had taken during the war.
All right. So
I had a playwriting teacher, Louise Mason, in college, who told me, if you can't tell me what your play is in one sentence, you don't have a play. And I find this a very useful comment. And I'm actually subbing for my wife at her class at Northwestern tonight, where she's teaching basically entrepreneurs, engineers, how to tell stories, and using a lot of sort of improvisation. And it was on another podcast, another book, that you were quoted, which is why I was so excited to talk to you. And I might be paraphrasing, but the line that I read from you that I thought was devastating and sums up your work, at least here, is you said something like, the world has a social safety net, the U.S. has women.
Yes, unfortunately. Other countries have invested in social safety nets to help people manage risk. They use things like taxes and regulations, especially on wealthy people and corporations, to protect people from falling into poverty, give people a leg up in reaching economic opportunities, and just to help people live with dignity, you know, regardless of how much money that they earn. In the US, we've taken a different path. We've tried to, what I talk about as sort of DIY society, which means, you know, keeping taxes low, slashing huge holes in the safety net that we do have, and really telling people that, you know, if you just make good choices, everything will turn out okay, and you won't actually need government support at all. But the problem is that you can't actually DIY society. I mean, forcing people to manage that much risk on their own has left, you know, many American families and communities really teetering on the edge of collapse. And yet we actually haven't collapsed, because what we've figured out is that we can get women to hold it together instead. We can get women to fill in those gaps in our economy and gaps in the kind of threadbare safety net that we do have, which means women, you know, being the default caregivers for children, for the sick and for the elderly, and also the ones who fill the lowest paid jobs in our economy. Women hold roughly 70% of America's lowest paid jobs. And those jobs are often too labor intensive to be profitable or highly paid. You know, things like jobs in childcare or home health care, customer service. And so there's an incentive to have a sort of flexible workforce that can be put into those jobs or forced into those jobs, because that's the best option they can get, because it keeps costs low for the rest of us and means that we don't have to fund them with tax dollars instead.
So there's a few villains in this book, and one of them is the National Association of Manufacturers. Tell us about them and what role they have played in setting up, which is not only something that is inequitable, but is insane.
Sure. I mean, so this is where, like, it almost feels tinfoil hat to talk about in terms of, you know, how much of a sort of collusion there was going on behind the scenes to get us to where we are today. And so I talk about in the book this DIY society model, and where does this come from? And really, it traces back to the 1930s, when the National Association of Manufacturers, who are sort of these corporate elites and their cronies, were trying to promote this DIY model as an alternative to the kind of social safety net that other countries were putting in place at the time, and the kind of social safety net that was being proposed as part of things like Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. And so they were looking for ways to kind of push back against higher taxes, against big government programs. And what they found was this idea of neoliberalism, which was being developed by a group of Austrian economists at the time. And those economists argue that societies are actually better off without a social safety net, because if people don't have a net to fall back on, they'll be less likely to take risks. They'll be more likely to make the kinds of good choices that will keep themselves safe from harm. Or at least that's the theory. Now, it's been sort of thoroughly debunked, you know, through subsequent research. But at the time, this was appealing to these wealthy business owners. And so they paid to import those American or those Austrian economists who developed the theory, and actually installed them in sort of endowed professorships at elite, you know, universities in the US, where they then went on to train the next generation of American economists and policymakers and business leaders. And that included folks like Milton Friedman, who went on to play a sort of key role in shaping U.S. social policy, and who also helped to orchestrate sort of massive propaganda campaigns, things like General Electric Theater, which was a massively popular television program that was hosted by Ronald Reagan, and that used these sort of popular stories, kind of fictionalized accounts of daily life, to create this perception among many Americans that we don't really need a social safety net, that if we just work hard enough, if we just have the right mindset, you know, we'll be able to get by without the kind of protection that a social safety net would provide.
If there's a theme to this podcast, and we've been doing it for like 7 years, it's that it's usually Milton Friedman's fault. So I think I want that as a t-shirt, put it on the back, because it's like, it's over and over again. And when he showed up in this book, I'm like, I can't believe, here it goes again. It's Milton Friedman.
Milton
Oh my
Friedman and
God.
Ronald Reagan together. I mean, the two of them, it's quite the cabal.
Well, yeah, and it was interesting too because I didn't know where the book was necessarily going to go, and it's frankly debunking a lot of moral panics. So you bring up Reagan, and certainly that's the welfare queen stuff that you talk about. But in the first chapter, you write in the first chapter, which is called "Making Them Mothers in Waiting." Quote, "The engineers of our DIY society have turned motherhood into a trap." So tell us how that plays out.
Sure. So essentially, as I talked about before, women can be one of the, as I talked about before, we figured out that we can manage a DIY society, or at least not collapse under the weight of a DIY society by forcing women to be the ones who hold it together instead. And certainly there's lots of ways to force people into that kind of exploitative system. And it's not just women who are pushed into doing the work of the social safety net, holding those kinds of unpaid or underpaid roles in our economy. But motherhood, and particularly the way that we treat motherhood in the US, makes it particularly easy for women to be forced into those kinds of exploitative relationships once they become responsible for the care of young children. And so essentially, in the absence of universal paid family leave, in the absence of universal affordable childcare, and in the presence of gender norms that treat women as these sort of natural best caregivers for children, moms can be easily forced into doing a disproportionate share of this labor because they know that there's no backstop. They know that they are the ones responsible for protecting children, and they can be easily sort of pushed into doing that work or taking whatever jobs are necessary to support their children, to support their families. And actually, our welfare system is designed to facilitate that kind of exploitation. Things like our, you know, TANF, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or what's often called welfare, has work requirements attached to it. And so what that means is that for low-income women, you know, disproportionately, it's low-income single mothers who end up on welfare because of the sort of requirements around who's allowed to qualify. And so if those women are required to find paid work just to qualify for their, you know, benefits, which in Indiana, where I was doing most of my research, the max that a mom of two could qualify for is about $288 a month. So even to keep those
nothing
at all, to keep those meager benefits, they also have to find paid work, even though every dollar they earn from paid work docks what they get from welfare. And so that kind of a system, I talk about in the book, a mom that I call Brooke, who she accidentally got pregnant in college and initially thought she was going to get an abortion, but her own mom persuaded her to keep the baby and kind of promised, oh, we'll help you finish college. You know, we'll figure this out. But her family wasn't a very high income family and couldn't afford to pay for college and for childcare. And, you know, her home life was a particularly rocky one. And so Brooke didn't trust her parents to watch her son for her. And so that meant she didn't have childcare and had to drop out of college and went on welfare, which then meant she had to find a job. And so she ended up ironically becoming a childcare provider herself because that was the best job that she could find to sort of satisfy those work requirements and also make it possible for her to work for pay herself. Because she talked about how at the time she was paying as much for childcare as she was for rent. And so working in childcare gave her a discount on childcare. And so that's, and you know, at the same time, that was basically a minimum wage job. And even when she got promoted to assistant director of the center, she was only making $25,000 a year. And so this is not, I mean, this is how we sort of force women to fill in these gaps in our economy and in our social safety net by turning motherhood essentially into a trap.
So as I was reading your book, I read over a weekend, as I often do, and my wife is also a big reader. We both worked at Second City for over 30 years. We're both executives here, and our kids are gone or grown. And, you know, when something went down with the kids, Anne went and dealt with it. I didn't. And so there was a lot of like, oh, my God, and totally seeing myself inside this. And the other thing that you note, though, is that we are part of this cycle, people like my wife and I, and imagine you as well. You write in the book, quote, "In our DIY society, women in higher income families have the resources to outsource the work of cleaning their homes, feeding their families, and caring for their children and their aging parents, particularly if the exploitation of women in more vulnerable positions makes those services available at lower costs." And I think what you're saying there is, we're part of this. If we were to stand up and say no more, that's part of the cycle that has to be broken.
Absolutely. And I think we do have to acknowledge that this system that we live in disproportionately disadvantages low-income women and particularly women of color who are often left with nowhere to turn and nowhere to hide, nowhere to turn in the sense that the communities that they're part of often are so resource deprived that they have, you know, very few places that they can turn to others for support in navigating the risk that's been handed to them. And at the same time, if they're managing to hold it together, other people are around them are going to be turning to them to ask for support. And it's hard to say no when you know that the people around you also have needs, and when you know that you might need help yourself someday. So I think, you know, we have to see how this system is disproportionately disadvantaging those who are already the most vulnerable among us. And we also have to recognize how those of us who are in higher income positions are able to manage the precarity that we face, in part by outsourcing risk and responsibility onto others, and often other women, especially women of color and low-income women, who are in more vulnerable positions than we are. I talk in the book about a same-sex couple. One of the moms is called Holly, who realized during the pandemic how desperate the situation is for childcare providers, that these women, many of them low-income Latina women who were caring for their daughter, were making barely minimum wage, didn't have access to health insurance benefits. Many of them had huge rates of, or huge levels of medical debt or other types of debt that they were struggling with. And so when their center shut down, many of those women left their jobs and tried to find jobs elsewhere. And so that created conflict for Holly, who was struggling to be able to go back to a full-time paid work position, struggling to manage an equal relationship with her wife, struggling to be able to, you know, compete in the workforce with men who could, you know, pass this responsibility off to other women in their lives. And that was hard for her. She talked about kind of feeling guilty on the one hand for how, you know, her ability to do her work depended on the exploitation of others. But at the same time, she knew that, you know, her own success, her own ability to avoid precarity depended on that exploitation, and kind of felt like at the same time, you feel like you have to just hoard whatever opportunities you can get and just sort of sit on top of them as long as you can, even though you might feel a lot of guilt in the process.
But and I think there's been some recognition of this, certainly in culture. But as you say, because the system is so gendered, just saying to men do more, that's not going to solve anything.
I mean, certainly, I think we have to recognize there that there are perks to patriarchy in the sense that men, even if, you know, in an absolute sense, many couples would be better off financially if they had two partners working, that they'd, you know, be better off. Evidence suggests that couples are generally happier when they have a more equitable division of labor, when both partners are communicating better, to share more equally in the project of care. But at the same time, you know, for many men, this feels threatening to think about what they'd have to give up to be more equal partners. I talked to one dad, for example, who I call Dennis, who, you know, before he his wife had kids, he was making about $90,000 a year working in tech, and his wife was a social worker and making about $30,000 a year. And so between the two of them, they could have afforded to pay for full-time child care, but he ended up persuading his wife to stay home because in his view, you know, she'd be happier at home. And he talked about how it didn't make sense to spend half of her paycheck finding care. So sort of seeing this as her responsibility from the outset in terms of who should be responsible for this. And then once she was home, he was resistant to the idea of her going back to paid work, even when she wanted to, because for him, that meant that he never had to take, you know, days off when the kids got sick or when somebody needed to, you know, have a snow day or go to the doctor or have other things going on. It meant he could go to the gym after work, didn't have to worry about who was going to make dinner or have the laundry done. And so he talked about this as like, he talked about it ironically as the perks of her getting to stay home. So he was simultaneously like acknowledging that there's perks for himself, but still trying to frame it as this is better for her. She gets to stay home. This is where she wants to be. Her take was a little bit more mixed on that front. I think she appreciated the time with her kids, but would have liked a paid job, particularly one that pays better. But that gets back to how the structure of our economy, the fact that we pushed women not only into doing more of the unpaid labor, but also the underpaid jobs in our economy, the jobs that are too labor intensive to be highly profitable, things like social work, things like teaching, things like, you know, home health care and child care, that if we don't put substantial government subsidies into them, it's hard to make them work without underpaying those kinds of jobs. And that kind of gender pay gap makes it seem to couples like it's okay to exploit women, that it's okay to force women into these positions simply because they're paid less, when in fact, you know, the whole structure of our economy is designed to help us think that way.
Have you been following any of those sort of public discussions around John Haidt's new book around kids and cell phones and all that?
A little bit. I'm not too well versed in all of the details, but
So I'm sort of fascinated because the first part of I haven't read the book, but I know John's work pretty well, and he talks a lot about the importance of kids playing. Totally, obviously, that's something I agree with. We don't give kids enough time to play. But then he's pretty hardcore about the fact that he thinks there's a causation between not cell phone use, social media, and smartphones and teen suicide and depression and all that. And there's been some pushback because people are like, I don't know that the data is actually saying that because I don't know that you can control for all the other factors. And one of the thoughts I had, because Derek Thompson had a podcast about this morning with a detractor of Haidt's work, which is also, we spent the last 20 years telling people that you should talk more openly about things like mental health. You should be more expressive about your true feelings. And perhaps it's just that we're all recognizing that the system sucks. It's bad. And that people are suffering. And that my generation, probably not yours as much, but my generation, my parents' generation, you were not to talk about it. And when in fact, if you unlock this stuff, I'm like, there's tons of trauma that they weren't dealing with. And now we're dealing with it because we know generational trauma is true. And I think about this because I've seen data around people and marriages, motherhood, and that's going to save you and that's going to save the kids and all that. But I don't think the data really shows that.
Yeah, no, I'm certainly also a skeptic when it comes to blaming technology for our current problems, especially because we have a long history of blaming whatever the new technology is for
Oh
society's
yeah, we're
ill.
good at that.
We get used to
Video
it.
games, the violent video
Exactly.
games, remember that? Rap music. Yep.
Indeed, indeed. And so, I mean, I think at the same time, I think you're right to point to broader societal changes, both in the acceptability of talking about mental health challenges, and also, I think our society has gotten more precarious in ways that make life more stressful and more difficult, that we have continually underinvested in the kinds of support systems that would make it more possible for families to get by without stress and strain as they navigate, raising their children or caring for their elderly parents or kind of just getting by and finding jobs in our economy, that this DIY model that we're under is putting considerable strain on Americans, on their families, on kids even in the process too. And so I think we have to think about how, you can think about, I talk in the book a little bit about, falling college wage premiums. And so even the value of college doesn't have the payoff that it used to, which means that young kids feel like they not only have to compete to get into the best college possible so that they have that shot at that sort of top of the ladder job that pays well enough to have a sense of security and stability in their lives, but even that might not be enough. They might have to go to grad school and they might have to, get 10 internships to be able to find the right job that will pay them as much to have this sort of stable and secure life. And so we've created this rat race where everyone is struggling and striving because our society is so unequal to get one of those rare spots at the top of the ladder and to protect, to knock everybody else down behind them to keep their spot at the top. And that's stressful. And so I think it's not surprising to me that we see young people expressing high levels of mental distress, not only because it's more acceptable to talk about it today, but also because it's gotten harder in a more unequal and more precarious society to feel like you have a shot at stability, given the inequality that we're seeing and given the lack of support that we give people in just being able to make it by.
I mentioned I'm teaching this class for my wife around storytelling tonight, and I truly believe what we can give these students is a better. We're trying to make them more backable. We're trying to find a way, and stories are a way to do that. And they cause relation and connection and all things. And my friend Nir Eyal points out, of course, though, that he says it's not a superpower unless it can be used for evil. And I think the evil story of our country is this meritocracy myth, which is a whole chapter here. So in this case, it could say it's like, is it Ben Franklin's fault?
I mean, I think this meritocracy myth has long roots, and you can certainly see it in things like the writings of Ben Franklin, this kind of like early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. I mean, this is certainly there may be some truth to that, but it's not the whole truth. And I think that's where the meritocracy myth, it's easy for people to say, well, there, if I do work hard, if I do, put in place good practices, maybe I will have a better shot in life. But we have to kind of take a step back and say, what is this meritocracy myth trying to do? Where does it come from? And how might it be warping our sense of ourselves and our sense of what is possible and leading us to just justify inequality. So that this meritocracy myth is basically the idea that success is the product of hard work, and that anyone who has the right mindset and works hard enough should be able to get ahead or should be able to get by without support from the government, for example. And those ideas, they have an appeal to them, particularly in a society as unequal as ours is, because it means that, you know, no matter what part of society you were born into, with the right choices and with the right, you know, mindset, you'll be able to overcome whatever hardships or whatever circumstances you face. But the end result of that, and this kind of messaging gets promoted in lots of ways. It gets promoted through religious messaging and self-help books and lots of other, you know, forces in our cultural society. But it operates to divide us by race and class and religion and politics in ways that lead us to focus on our sense of moral superiority over others, that those of us who are even a little bit more successful, maybe we make just too much to qualify for welfare, for example, we can see ourselves as morally superior to those who fall just a little bit further down the economic ladder and who need that kind of economic support. And there were, you know, families that I talked to where a larger social safety net would have benefited them, would have, you know, given them an easier time in our society in navigating the kinds of financial pressures that they faced, but they rejected the need for that stronger social safety net, for things like universal health care or a higher minimum wage or universal, you know, child care, because it gave them a sense of moral superiority to be able to say, you know what, I don't need that. I'm frugal enough. I make good choices. I'm better than those moms who need to rely on a social safety net. And so I think we have to worry about what this kind of meritocracy myth is doing to us and how it's designed to keep us from seeing the value of a broader social safety net by encouraging us to focus on the kind of moral boundaries between us based on these ideas of hard work instead.
It seems impossible that an individual couldn't zoom out and recognize that none of us do this alone in any minute regard. I mean, I did not pave the street that I go down. I did not build the house I live in. I did not raise all the food I eat. I did not raise my kids alone. Like, no one does that. We are wholly reliant on so many other people and relying on these systems. And yet, I guess it's because, you know, it would require us to maybe do that thing that you're talking about, which is, you know, not think of ourselves as heroes. And especially as a mom thing you talk about in the book, which is like, why wouldn't a mom want to feel like a hero? And we call it, and I remember too around COVID, right? It was always like the all those child care workers, they're heroes. And it's like, we keep throwing the hero thing, but we're doing that without giving them anything else than the word.
Yeah, I mean, we valorize things that we ought to value in this society. And in the sense that we hold up on a pedestal, we talk about, you know, oh, we love moms and we celebrate motherhood and we celebrate caregivers. But we do that because we're not actually willing to support them in any meaningful way. But that kind of valorization, it feels good in the moment. And it makes us feel as though what we're doing is worthwhile, even if it requires self-sacrifice. And at the same time, I think we have to acknowledge how our society tells mothers in particular that their self-worth is defined by their sacrifice. And so that makes it tricky to kind of unpack some of this in the sense that you are a good mom if you sacrifice for your children. And so that makes it hard to feel as though you can ask for help, to feel as though you can be willing to acknowledge that there are other people who are helping to do this work too, that you have to say, I'm doing it all alone and I'm, you know, killing myself in the process, because that's what makes you a good mother. And that's, you know, a deeply problematic system in that it sort of guilts and gaslights mothers into feeling as though they don't deserve help and can't ask for it. But it's the kind of thing that helps to keep our system in place.
I don't imagine you're going to go on a lot of comedy podcasts to talk about this. And this isn't a comedy podcast, but look, I've worked at Second City my entire life. I'm a comedy expert. And you talk about the use of humor in here. And I'd love to dig into that a little bit, because I certainly know how humor can both bring us together and in the same moment exclude. You know, it's again, very powerful that way.
Yeah. And I think when I talk in the book about the role of especially sexist humor, and what the research shows on that front is that it's very easy for men in particular to buy into sexist humor, because because it's makes it easy to espouse these kinds of mythical ideas about gender that have that promote these perks of patriarchy, that make it easier for men to feel justified. Sorry, I turn purple sometimes. Make it easier to these this kind of humor makes it easier for men to feel as though they can accept the perks of patriarchy because it feels like, oh, you know, it's just a joke. It makes it easier to be into this idea that, oh, you know, women are just happier at home. But I can sort of, you know, walk it back if I need to. I can claim I'm just saying it jokingly if that's if I get called out on it, if I get pushed back. But the problem with that is that it also makes it harder for women to push back against this kind of humor in the sense that experimental studies have shown that when you present women with sexist messaging, either in the form of humor or in the form of, you know, a serious comment, it's much harder for them. They're much less inclined to, you know, to complain to authorities or to push back or to say, hey, don't say that kind of stuff when it's a joke, because it's harder in those moments for them to not feel like they're going to be accused of, you know, being too uptight, you know, taking things too seriously. Oh, it was just a joke. How could you know, how could you accuse me of being sexist? That essentially humor can operate to gaslight women when it's when sexism is put in those kinds of terms. And at the same time, it can make it easier for men to distance themselves from the kinds of things that they might believe because they can pass it off as humor. They can claim, oh, I don't really believe that. It's just a joke. Even if that ends up helping them feel justified in acting in sexist or misogynistic ways.
Yeah, and there's research to back that up. I think also I'm going to talk positively in the sense of I think Hannah Gadsby's work is a way of using humor to get across a message that if used without humor is men aren't going to listen to.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? And she found a way. I mean, it's almost like she sucked us in and we're like, well, we're there now. We've got to hear it. And that's a beautiful weapon to use in that regard.
And certainly, I think that gets at the difference between punching up and punching down in the sense of, you know, who is telling the joke and how that matters in terms of how it's perceived and the way that people from groups that have been systematically marginalized can use humor to call out power, to call out systems of power in ways that can make it harder for the people who are in those positions of privilege to defend the privileges that they have, in ways that, you know, humor can be used as a weapon on both ends, but to very different effects depending on who's wielding the sword.
Before we started taping, you and I were talking about our mutual friend, Ai-Jen Poo, and we created our Second City Improv for Caregivers program. And I actually just did a keynote for Hinge Health yesterday where I talked about the program and part of how we are using that for caregivers to be seen and to see others and ways to speak through difference. And a lot of that is based on science around self-disclosure, or it, more in fact, that we tend to not self-disclose, that we, you know, even sort of minor points, but when we do, we create these points of connection, which are hugely powerful. And I think one of the things, and this is in your last chapter that you talk about, is this idea of care linking our fates and flowing through networks. We all exist in networks of care. This is all true and all hugely important. And shoved to the side when it is the center.
Yes, and I think that gets at the fact that ideally a social safety net will not only help us to outsource the kind of some aspects of caregiving, you know, through things like universal childcare programs or things like universal healthcare, but can also help to facilitate more broader and more sustaining participation in a sort of shared project of care. That things like universal paid family leave, things like universal paid vacation time, even, or things like, you know, flexible work hours or limits on paid work hours can make it possible for all of us to be part of those networks of care and to be active participants in them and to be sharing in this necessary labor that can't all be outsourced, that we can't outsource all of the care for our children or all of the care for our aging parents or all of the care that we need when we're sick, that we always need some forms of informal care, and that the more that we can do to put people in a place where they are logistically and emotionally kind of ready and able to do that work of care, you know, the better off we will all be, regardless of what our policy structure happens to be. And that was, you know, maybe one of the saddest findings to come out of the pandemic research that my team and I did was how many couples mom and dad were both able to work from home, but mom ended up telling dad to go back to the office because he was getting so frustrated with the kids, so angry with the kids that it actually made things more difficult when he was at home. And this bore out in our national surveys too, where kind of white dads with college degrees were kind of off the charts compared to all other parents when we asked them, how often are you yelling at your kids during the pandemic? And it had to do with the fact that they were often able to work from home in a way that other dads weren't, but that they, unlike moms, weren't used to having to kind of navigate the day-to-day challenges of trying to work for pay while also caring for a gaggle of young kids. And that was deeply stressful for a lot of dads. They could use a program like yours to be able to help them navigate those moments where their kids, refuse to do their schoolwork or won't put their shoes on or whatever it happens to be. Because in those moments, and then moms end up taking the brunt of it because they're the ones who have to step in. I talked to one mom, for example, who she told her husband, stop working from home, even though she had the stress of being the primary childcare provider for her three kids while also working for pay. She ended up gaining 40 pounds in 3 months. She went back on antidepressants. She was drinking more heavily. So she was internalizing all of this stress, but she still felt like she was in a better position emotionally to help the kids than her husband because he was just yelling at them all the time.
So the hopeful aspect of all of this is it really is fixable. This is not, it's fixable, right? So
Definitely.
I know what's standing in the way. So I'd say if I'm going to go to the number one thing standing in the way for me, it's the incentives are bad. How about for you? Do you think that, or you say resources in the book too, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Certainly, I think the problem is not that we couldn't do this resource-wise, that we actually have the money in our system to pay for all of these things, that we just need to change where the money is allocated, whose pockets it's coming out of and where it happens to go. Really, the problem is a sort of will problem in the sense that this idea of a DIY society, so many of us have bought into it in part because of myths like the myth of meritocracy, that we've become complacent, that we have become sort of, and we've accepted the idea that even if some parts of life might be better with a social safety net, that we can get by without them. And that even if we're putting a lot of stress on women, that they're sort of making it through and that we're able to kind of make that work, even if it's not the ideal. And so I think there's also kind of worries about, could we do this larger system? Could we make these big changes? Even though, we've already proven that we could do this, both with childcare during World War II and with things like Social Security and Medicare that were tremendously helpful in lifting millions of elderly Americans out of poverty and making sure that they had access to the healthcare they needed to live long, healthy lives. And so we can do this, but there's a lot of fear driven by this kind of mythical messaging that dissuades us from thinking that it's possible and from feeling like it's worth it to pursue this kind of alternative to the status quo.
All right, we always end the podcast asking for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
Sure. So this book itself kind of comes from a yes and story in the sense that I started the research looking at mothers of young children before the pandemic. I was following a group of about 250 moms from pregnancy through their first couple of years postpartum. I was interested at the time in sort of the best laid plans of parenthood in the sense of you have these ideas about the kind of parent that you want to be, and then life intervenes and things go wrong and you have to change course. And how does that make you feel about yourself in the process? And what kinds of decisions do you make? And we'd started that research recruiting moms during pregnancy in 2018 and 2019, and we were hoping to follow them for about 2 years. And so we were still in the field doing interviews and surveys with these moms when the pandemic hit in 2020. And so at that point, I had a 5-year-old and 2-year-old of my own at home, and their school and child care center closed. And so I'm trying to teach my classes and do my research. And it was one of those moments where I felt like I could just shut the project down. Like, I don't know if I can keep doing this. I'm not sure if I have the bandwidth to keep doing interviews to kind of figure out, what's going on here, let alone take care of my kids and do all my other stuff. But the stories that I heard, the stories that we heard, even, in early March, February, from these moms that we were talking to about how their lives were changing, about the stress that they were under, about the weight that was being put on their shoulders, felt to me like one of those moments where I couldn't say no, where, both because of what I was experiencing myself at home and what I was hearing in the stories of these women who I'd been following for a year or so at that point, that it felt like kind of the morally responsible choice to keep the project going. And so we ended up doing 3 more waves of pandemic data collection, talking to these moms and their partners and some of their network contacts about their experiences during the pandemic. And really, this book came out of those pandemic experiences in particular, given the way that the pandemic choices that we made pushed responsibility disproportionately onto women. And also, in some moments, kind of created possibilities for hope. Like we had Build Back Better. It sort of pushed us in this direction of seeing. We had the idea of it, at least for a little while. And I was sort of hopeful that, maybe we'll see a new path. Maybe this will be the way through. And then when we didn't, that was sort of the final straw for me of, okay, I have to write this book to figure out how things went wrong and how we got to this point where we didn't build back better, even when we had the chance.
The book is called Holding It Together, How Women Became America's Social Safety Net. Jessica Clarko, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.